Welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, back again on my irregular schedule. I like to keep people guessing for when the podcast is coming out. I think that's good marketing. Rhetoric Warriors podcast, complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So let's turn up the heat a little bit on how we understand how we talk to each other. I'm Dr. Dan, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer, rhetorician, comedian, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I used to be in Austin. Now I'm in semi-sunny today, California. On the podcast, I do a few things. I talk to comedians sometimes about their views and their careers and their politics. Sometimes I have conservatives on here and I try to sway them because that's always fun for me. I chat with cause havers, people that are trying to get things out into the world. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. More rhetoricians on my podcast than any other podcast you'll hear today. This is another episode of what I would call Persuasion Pros. My guest, I've known her for a few years now, super cool person. She's a Texan. She wears cow boots, at least she used to, white and black, real cowhide. She's also an executive coach and speaker, big background in tech startups as a CEO. There's a new book out titled No Permission Needed and some strong views about succeeding in boardrooms and on being female in male-dominated industries. Tissa Richards.
It's so good to see you, Dan. It's been way, way too long. And yes, I am still wearing those cowboy boots everywhere I go.
Yeah, they're a good signature.
It is. Yeah, it's fun and they're comfortable. So yeah, gotta have your signature, your brand, you know?
Well, you've got the name Tissa, which, what is Tissa from? Was it Patricia?
No, it's literally just a made up name, but it's great because I don't have to pay for SEO. So
yeah, you're the only Tissa I know.
I am the only Tissa I know as well. So it's great.
Now, are you originally from Texas? I know your dad's Australian, right?
Yeah, no, I've actually grown up sort of all over. So I grew up in Canada. I've lived in Australia. My mom is actually born in Europe, dad in Australia. So very international, which is really fun. It gives you a really great perspective on kind of the world and people and different cultures. So but I hide my Canadian accent really well.
You do. You have zero Canadian accent.
No, it only comes out when I say the word sorry. That's the only time that I think it slips out. I don't apologize very often.
That could be Minnesota. That could be sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So who gave you Tissa? Who labeled you with Tissa? What culture did that come from?
You'd have to ask my mom. I think it's just a random name, and which is fun though. It was hard to find magnets and, like, you know, when you're a kid and there's swag like at Disney or whatever. Never found a magnet with my name on it. But again, that was kind of a fun thing. So
you're too unique for those people.
Yeah. Never had a magnet with my name on it, but that's okay. I'm over it now.
You're over it. That's good. Yeah. So run your background a little bit for everybody and then we will dive in. There's all sorts of things to talk about. You actually have a big background in communication. That was your education, and you do your own marketing, I think, for a lot of things. So we have tons of things to jump into, but run your background a little bit for everybody.
Yeah, I like to say I'm a recovering tech founder, and I don't want to make light of addiction, but I, you know, it's always that worry that you're going to wake up and go, oh God, I started another software company last night, but I'm doing a really good job of resisting that. But yeah, I've started and funded and led technology companies. I have a bunch of cybersecurity patents and just kind of burned out on, I think we glamorize entrepreneurship. We glamorize being a founder, and really it's not sexy, Dan. It's exhausting. It takes a lot of years off your life. And it's hard to thrive when you're also scaling a company and dealing with sort of the competing interests of investors and customers and a team and trying to raise money. So after I did that, I thought, okay, I had enough. That was fun. It was many years. And now I have a mission to create a legion of leaders with an unshakable sense of self and all the things that come with it, the ways to get there and the benefits that infers both to the individual and the organization. So it's really fun. And not having investors, not having sort of a board to report to, kind of gives you that freedom to just do the things that you really love every day. And I love every day of what I do.
Yeah, it's really, you know, I've worked in big universities and big TV studios, and you're surrounded by a bunch of cool people and talented people, and there's energy to it, and there's vitality and community. But, you know, like, I've spent the last year in this one bedroom apartment right on the beach, pretty much talking to a buddy of mine every once in a while and going to the gym. And I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good too. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of change the pace sometimes and realize, like, wow, you know what? Like, I think sometimes when you work that hard, or you're, what are you chasing? Right. I knew I wasn't thriving. I think I mentioned this. I don't think it's in the book, but I think I was interviewed for Authority magazine, and I realized I was not thriving when I was traveling all over the world, walking through airports and hotels, and just crying, not sad, but just leaking exhaustion in the physical form of tears. And I thought, okay, this is a really good signal that I'm not thriving and I'm probably not really enjoying this anymore. It's time to listen to that and sort of say, maybe should we do a pivot? Should we do something else where every day is amazing now? And that's where I am now. And so, yeah, I think a lot of people don't step back and say, do I really love what I do? And if not, why not? You know?
Yeah, there are physical symptoms you got to pay attention to. Like, when I was a professor, I knew it was time to quit. Like, I had a student come into my office and I looked up to see who it was. And as soon as I saw her, I physically shuddered. I went, oh, to the point where she's like, are you okay?
And
I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I knew what she was there for, to, you know, try to weasel her way up to a grade. And I'm like, I don't want to play this game again. So I'm like, you know what? I think I've lost my empathy chip for them.
Yeah. And that, it is a good sign, right? Where you're sort of thinking, you probably started out doing it because you loved it. And then over the years that you sort of have these diminishing returns, or it's attrition of why you're doing it and how much you love it versus what it's giving to you, things like that. And that's, you've got to pay attention, because otherwise, if you're not thriving, your work's not thriving, or the company is not thriving. And then why are you there?
I sometimes think of it, there's a glowing core inside of everything that you love. And then it's surrounded by all these dark monkeys, you know, the flying monkeys and everything else. And you're like, I just want to, and like, being a professor, teaching was great. Teaching good students was great. Yes. Teaching awful students was awful. And so, like, all the things that keep pulling you away from that glowing core, and you're finally like, you know what, I'm going to go reduce. And like you said, find something that's a little bit closer to what I can control, I think.
Totally. Totally. I haven't heard the term flying monkeys in a while, but yeah, I think if there are flying monkeys in your life, what can you do to get rid of them? I kind of always, so many people, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah, you can say whatever. It's a podcast.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I always promise people I'm not going to, and then I forget. Yeah. But, you know, it's kind of like having a no assholes rule, right? And then when you realize, wait, I've let them creep back in, got to tighten back up on that rule. But if, not to say that I follow Marie Kondo, but if your work or whatever is not sparking joy, why not? Like, step back and say, when did I turn off that sort of part of the measurement to say, wait, it's supposed to, it's not. And whether it's flying monkeys or assholes everywhere, you got to step back and say, okay, we're going to recalibrate. Life's way too short to be miserable.
So you think a lot of people are intimidated by, I mean, you get sort of, this is, it's been, I've been working with businesses, I guess, the last 7 years now. And, you know, business is its own culture, has its own way of talking about the world and its own ways of teaching and inspiration. And it can be very, you know, sometimes glib and cliche ridden with things like, you know, just follow your dreams, and, you know, you got to have your passion. And you hear people who are very good presenters, you know, and they can present that stuff really well. And I'm always like, yeah, the content's kind of paper thin. But how do you, when you talk about that, like, what do you tell people when you say, like, hey, you know, saying pivot is easy. It's an easy word. It's an easy concept. But what's your advice for people when they actually want to do that? Because you made a hard pivot.
I really did. And it came at a huge financial cost. I mean, I think that's, you also have to take that into account, right? I mean, I think I get really, really, I mean, you've known me long enough that you know that I get annoyed if I just go and all I'm hearing is hot air. So there's some great speakers, right? Great keynote speakers, motivational speaker. And you think, okay, but I didn't come just to be inspired. I can just go listen or read to something and be inspired. Somebody the other day said, you are quite possibly the most efficiently pragmatic person I've ever met. And I thought, okay, that's actually good. That's what
solid.
I want to be. Yeah, right? Because I think we're all so busy. And if you're not taking something very tangible from anything you do, at least for me, then I get a little annoyed. So I think, yeah, it is easy to say, just go pivot, just go do what you love. But those kind of, you know, that those sayings, do what you love and the money will come. Well, that's kind of bullshit, because what if you love making macrame e-cigarette holders? Or maybe there's a big market. I don't know. But I think there's probably things that you love, and it's not going to feed your family. It's not going to create sort of any financial stability or whatever. But I think there's still ways to say, what are the things that you really love? What are the things that you really don't? And there's enough of a vein or a through line in what you do like and what you are good at, that you can, especially at a certain point in your career, you can step back and say, okay, you don't get the greatest value from me when I do that, or I'm known for this and I love this, so I'm going to look for a job or a role or a company where that's what I'm doing. And I think, so it's not being glib by saying, oh, just go do the things that you love, but try to do more of it, or at least acknowledge that, hey, I really don't like whatever it is. Maybe it's managing vendors. I don't know. There's a million things you probably don't love and a million things you do. So trying to find more of a balance, but you have to be pragmatic and prosaic about it, because the reality is you have to pay for groceries. You can't pay for groceries with equity in a startup or hopes and dreams and, you know, but I love what I do. So I think you do still have to be pragmatic about it.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things I've always liked about you, is you have it's very clear that you're not just offering fluff about things. You're not interested in fluff about things. You cut right to the core of things. And I even saw this, like when you talk about dealing with boards, you know, or being a female in male dominated industries, you're like, yeah, you can whine about this stuff if you want, or you can get good at it. You know, and that to me is something I always admired about you, because you just cut all that away and be like, okay, hey, you're in a tough environment. Let's see how you succeed.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, I think I do sometimes get put on a panel or a stage to talk about how, not to diminish the reality that a lot of women do struggle sometimes, but I think you can over-index on ascribing gender, or ascribing some things to what your identity is, right? I just had a conversation about this yesterday with a really interesting woman who's been a journalist for years and is now starting a tech company. And she said, well, it sounds like you've never had a gendered experience. And knock on wood, I have not. I've had people say, well, would it have been easier to raise money as a man? I can't A/B test that for you. So I can't tell you. I know it's a lot easier if you've already sold a company to Google. So it's just, it's difficult. It's hard. It's hard no matter who you are. But I think that so much of the work I do is to say, don't look for the hard things, because you will find them. Look for the ways to just be really, really kick-ass. Look for the things that you are good at. Look for how to make yourself the best communicator. How to walk into a room and listen. How to walk into a room and figure out the power dynamics. How to walk into a room and have great presence. Prepare, prepare, prepare. Be smart. Don't ever pretend to know something you don't. There's so many things that you can do that, you know, I get really annoyed when someone says, oh, I get man interrupted all the time. Are you sure? You sure you're not just getting interrupted because you don't know when to shut up, for example? And I've actually walked a few of my clients through that. And at the end they go, yeah, I think I just really needed to up level my communication skills. Or again, there are cases where people are assholes or people, but I think I've met a lot of equal opportunity assholes. So
right.
I do think that you can sort of over index on being a victim and then under index on becoming just a really effective leader.
Yeah. And I think most people would give you that point. Like if they really thought about it, that you can ascribe things to gender, you can ascribe things to age, you can ascribe things to a lot of different factors. But one thing that you can control is your skill level, you know, and your approach. And since that is the one thing you can control, you know, that's probably where you should put most of your energy.
Yeah. I again, I think very well said, because I know you're a master at words, but yeah, control what you can, right? And then don't spend a lot of time focusing on the things that you can't, because I think what is the result going to be? Frustration, a lack of resilience, just getting really annoyed. That's not going to help you.
In comedy, I used to have a joke about, you hear people in relationships, they'll be like, you know, why don't you listen to me? You know, why don't you ever just sit down and listen to what I have to say? And I'm like, are you listening to yourself? That's not very pleasant.
Yeah. Like,
you know, give me some incentive here, you know, other than the whip, you know? So I think a lot of times that sort of, and again, like, you know, we talked about this at different points, like there's victim psychology, there's victim politics, and then there's empowered politics and empowered psychology. And it sounds like that's one of your things is always to flip that. Be like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I know what being female here could mean, but let's flip it and see, you know, what we can do on the other side of it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think you're absolutely right. I think it's walking into any situation and just saying, how do I optimize the outcome here? And so much of that is preparation. It's credibility, and it's not opening your mouth if you don't know the answer, or just saying, I don't know, and let me go find out, or let me learn, or tell me about it, right? And that really helps. But I think, I really like that, Dan, moving from a victim to an empowered mentality. I think I do a lot of work there helping people with that.
Yeah, and I think from a rhetoric standpoint, these are just identity options that you can grab for yourself. And each one of them has power. Each one of them has limits. And that's what you're offered in the world is here's a set of, you know, like a pie chart of identities. You can reach in and grab a slice. And some people move in between identities, depending on where they are and what they're trying to do. And they're strategic about it. But other people absorb it. And then it just becomes their only option. And from a strategy perspective, that's not very good to have one go-to card all the time over and over again. It's going to fail you, you know, at a certain point, no matter how strong it is.
Yeah. And it is interesting too, right? Because I think a lot of times an organization will identify somebody as, let's say, a high potential leader. And that's when I think you have this, the word just left my brain. It's been a long day. That's when you have this flexion point or this point of either you can take that and really run with it, really skill up and be inspired by it. Or some people, I think at that point, almost collapse under that pressure of thinking, wait, I don't know what to do with this. I think it's too much too soon. And I've seen it happen so many times, and it's really a shame, because that's when I think a lot of times we get that victim, the attribution to a variety of things. I didn't have a lot of mentors. I didn't have a lot of people who looked like me. I didn't have a lot of examples. But that's a really great time to be very, very proactive. Reach out, find somebody, find a skip level sponsor or mentor. Just do what you can, right? And I think it's literally being very, very proactive about reaching the next level instead of, I think a lot of people wait. And they have this sort of, they figure that their career is going to go along with momentum. But we always think momentum is a great word, right? Oh, the project has momentum. But momentum actually becomes inertia eventually. And so I actually like to say, I think momentum is very dangerous to your career, as opposed to being very intentional about how you're constantly developing yourself and your skills and your relationships and your network.
So you said like you really love what you're doing now. So talk about that a little bit. Like what's a typical day, or talk about a gig that you've done that you really like. I remember, I think the last time we reconnected was I saw you on Facebook and you were in one of the super skyscrapers in New York.
Yeah.
And you were like a picture of you and you're in a boardroom and there are people sitting around, and then, you know, it's so high up and there's Central Park, I think. It was, yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, what have you been up to?
Yeah, it was really, that was cool. And they kept insisting I have the view, and thought I will be able to focus. It was beautiful. Yes. So every day is different. Every day is amazing. And I would say that, I mean, I told you the mission, right? So it's to create this sort of unshakable sense of self. And I think there's really a reason for that for me. I want people to be able to very clearly, and not in a very long, awful elevator pitch kind of way, but literally three sentences, be able to say, hey, What do they do? Why does it matter? What are they looking to do? Be very memorable and talk about the value they bring, the values they operate on. But we have trouble. Many people have trouble. And 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes later, they're still regurgitating the audible version of their resume to you. Everybody's eyes have rolled back in their heads. If you're in a networking situation, they've gone to the bar to get a drink, or in an interview, they're just sort of going, oh, save me. And I think that it comes from a place of, I don't know how to just be really specific about myself or the company I work for, or just, I don't know how to say what I do, what I want to do, what I want to get out of any interaction. And that tends to cause things like vacuums, like imposter syndrome or doubt, or just, do I belong here? Or people don't know then how to articulate their non-negotiables even. So whether it's their values or a company culture, or just if something doesn't smell right or feel right, they're afraid to just stand up and say, you know what, really love the job, really love the company, but this situation isn't right. So it was really driven by this sense of, I want everybody to operate with zero fear. Nothing's fatal. If you decide to leave, I shut down my last company, it cost a lot of money. It didn't impact, I mean, all it did was just accelerate into this. Yeah. Operate with no fear. Know exactly who you are so you can be really authentic. That really creates a lot of resilience. And then you can really just optimize your potential. I don't mean that in a squishy way, but it's that clarity, it's that precision. It's knowing exactly who you are and being able to say to people, hey, this is what I'm known for. This is what I'm looking to do. You know, how can I help you? Who do you know that I can help? And how could I help you? So it's just, it's precision of words, right, of knowledge of your value. It's precision. And I think we're afraid to be precise about ourselves because we think we're going to knock off opportunities. But actually what it does is, by being narrow, it opens the aperture. It's counterintuitive.
No, I agree with all of that. I ran into this first in screenwriting and entertainment with people who wanted to be comedy writers, or they wanted to be screenwriters because I taught screenwriting. And I remember going to the Austin Film Festival for years as a panelist, and they had these cool little setups where they would do a round table with there'd be six industry people and then maybe 15 attendees at the table, and you would just switch tables. So you would talk to maybe four different tables.
It's like speed dating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so every time I would sit down, I'd be like, okay, who's got a great script? Pitch me. And they'd be like, like silence. And then, you know, sometimes you get an aggressive one and they would start to pitch, and I'd be like, yeah, you lost me. So let me teach y'all how to pitch. Let me teach you how to pitch a script, because you're all here trying to sell things. You're all trying to move into an industry. And the main thing that everybody's going to use to evaluate you very quickly is, do you have a 30-second version of your script that I can hear and that, you know, tags me, it gets me interested? But nobody teaches you how to script that. They tell you that, hey, you need to pitch it, but they don't teach you how to do it. And so giving them, like you said, specific scripts, here's the exact way to do it. Say these things, 30 seconds, and then shut up and let
And then shut up. But so isn't that funny, right? I think that's also a really big part of it, is knowing when to stop talking and having the confidence to not sell yourself. That's a really big part of the work that I do as well, because I think that, and this comes back to the communication, the ability to just, if you're not talking, no one can interrupt you, right? And I think a lot of people don't know when to stop. And there's the quietest person in the room is usually the most powerful. And I think there's just the ability to just, if you can find your own signal in the noise, that's a huge executive skill. It's a leadership skill. It's a boardroom skill. It's a lifetime skill, but a lot of people aren't good at it.
Yeah. And I think, again, we aren't trained to it, and your advice about making it narrow so that you can handle the information. Everybody's information wants to sprawl. That's what it does. And if you are trying to do verbal information to other people, you're going to lose. What you need in things like, you know, introducing yourself and, you know, setting out who you are, it's just about psychological triggers. That's all the words are for. It's really not about information. Like when I do this, I tell people when they ask me what I do, I'm like, well, I'm a master rhetorician. And people are like, what's that?
What's that?
And,
yeah. Wait, what word
then
did
I
you
win.
Say?
you know, because now we're in dialogue. I've gotten an emotional reaction, a curiosity, and, you know, we can talk about what that is. And I've got it scripted out because I've done it so many times. Super comfortable introducing myself now because I've done it probably, I don't know, 1500 times. So,
you know, I talk about in my book, Dan, I talk about how, and my most popular keynote right now is called Ditch the Pitch, because I think it's the worst thing that people have ever been taught, that they need to have an elevator pitch about themselves. It just, they make me break out in hives. But I thought, you know, what it's bad to just say to people, don't do something. So what do we replace it with instead? Is what I was thinking of, kind of what you just said, right? Which is, you've got to give somebody something that they could be curious about, that they can anchor onto. And so I've been suggesting that people instead replace it with what I think of as a catalyst statement. So literally two sentences, maybe three, but that's getting a little long. So you really control the narrative about yourself. How does somebody understand you, remember you? And then what action do you want to prompt? So if I hear you say that, I'm going to think that's going to prompt curiosity. It's going to prompt dialogue. But I also want to prompt people. As soon as I meet somebody, I can't help this. I instantly start thinking, oh, I've got to introduce Dan to this person, to this person, to this person, because I love connecting people. But if you're really specific too about what you're looking for, hey, I'm looking to keynote at sales kickoffs. I'm looking to do a TEDx talk, whatever. I'm looking to get on a board. Who do you know that I can help? Who do you know that you can introduce me to? You're kind of reducing the cognitive load for people of like, I got a big network. But now if you're saying, who's two people that you know that I could help, or that, and giving them the specificity like that and controlling who in their 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon they could start that with is really helpful. And you're reducing the workload for them. You have to be specific. Otherwise people will just go, it was really great meeting you, and go get a drink, you know?
Yeah. I've had hundreds of stand-ups who've come up to me and asked me how to get into TV writing and how to write for late night talk shows. And I'm like, well, you need a packet. You need a writer's packet. 2 pages of jokes, of monologue jokes from the news, 2 pages of sketch ideas. That's at least the basics. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, you know, if you want to write that up and send it to me, I will give you feedback on it. And once it gets to a level where it would impress a professional head writer, then start trying to work on getting it to somebody. Very specific steps, because I know the industry. I know exactly how it works. I know exactly where they will fail. And I know that most of them will be like, I can't, you know, and they'll never even send me anything.
Yeah.
But I make a very authentic offer about it. Even like screenplays, when I would go to the film festival, I'd be like, you guys have something you want to pitch me, you know, here's my email. Just hit me up. Like, I don't care. I'll look at your pitch. It'll take me 30 seconds to decide if I like it. I'll give you a little bit of feedback. And if I like it, I'll help you with it. So, but like two people reached out to me out of hundreds.
Isn't it amazing? Like how people just sort of, you have this golden opportunity, but I think a lot of people are afraid. Again, I think a lot of people are driven by fear. Oh my gosh, now it's getting real. It's not ready. It's not perfect. But perfection is the enemy of just getting started, you know, just send something. Chances are, it's probably not fabulous, but at the very least, you could give a feedback, which would say, my suggestion is XYZ, you know?
And you said one of my magic words earlier, which is develop, like development. And then again, in Hollywood, you get thrown into development, which means, yeah, we like something about this. Who knows how many people are going to touch it after that? 50, 100, 10 different writers. You know, you can't control that. What you're hoping for is that all those people are adding some good stuff. And if you don't understand development when you're trying to put something good together, or when you're trying to learn skills, it is about development. It's not about being, I'm terrible. I'm like, I don't care if you're terrible. What I care about is if you can't learn. You know, if I can't see progression in you or dedication to progress, then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
But
a willingness
just, you know,
to listen.
Yeah.
Right. It's just, yeah. Yeah. My least favorite thing is when I ask somebody a question. I mean, as a coach or a leadership facilitator, you don't have all the answers, but it's to ask a question. And when you get somebody who says, well, but, and it's dismissive, and you're like, wait a second.
What am I going to do with that?
Why are we here? Wasn't this meant to be sort of a dialogue of like moving the ball forward? But okay, no worries. I'm busy. I can move on to the next thing. But when somebody literally says, but I think, okay, I guess status quo is where this is going to stay for the next little while, which is fine, but that's probably why we got into this pickle in the first place, you know?
Right. Well, yeah. And as a writer, as a comedy writer, I work with a lot of performers who hire me and then they're like, I don't know about this joke. I'm like, well, if you were able to write and pick the right jokes, you wouldn't need a writer. So why don't you just perform it? If it doesn't work, fine, you know, but I think it will, you know, so quit using your own, kind of what you're talking about. It's a cover for fear. It's a cover for taking a chance. It's a cover for their own ego, as opposed to opening yourself to somebody like you, who's like, well, if somebody's going to hire you to help them develop, they have to be fully open to that process, right? For it to work.
Yeah, there's a lot of vulnerability, right? In somebody coming to you and saying, okay, I know I'm not at the pinnacle of whatever. I'm not. It's really interesting. I hadn't ever had a coach. And over the past few years, I've been on the receiving end, whether it's speaking or whatever. And it's a weird, I can kind of see sometimes where my clients have that little bit of, oh, you're on the hot seat, because it's strange coaching all day and then being coached. And you think, okay, I have a lot more empathy now for the people I work with. Because it's a strange feeling to suddenly go from having expertise to being coached. Kind of humbling, actually.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, there are many, many things that, like, I don't know why I'm talking about entertainment so much tonight, but like, I don't act. Like, I can direct, I can write, I can do produce, but I'm a terrible actor and I don't want to get better. I just don't want to do it. And so I used to get drug into sketches all the time when I worked on talk shows. I've been on national TV, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 times. I'm in the Actors Guild, for God's sakes. And I'm an awful actor and I hate everything about it. And I'm like, you know, I'm sure I could improve. I don't want to put any energy there. So I just eliminate it, which, you know, if you're, again, like you said, aware of your strengths and your wants and what you're after, those are easy things to say. And I've had people say, you literally just say, I don't do that. And I'm like, yeah, I don't even try.
And that's okay. I forgot you were in the Actors Guild. You probably liked the anecdote in the book that I wrote to Oprah like regularly for, it was probably over 2 years. And it's kind of embarrassing now because it was probably like 11, 12, 13, 14. So it was a while ago now, but I thought she was too old. I thought she should retire. And the fact that she hasn't tells you that I was a little off base, but I kept sending her letters saying, you know, I know you're about to retire. You should be retiring. And you can train me to be a replacement for free. I'll come. I thought it was a very generous offer, Dan. I mean,
that sounds generous to me. Come on, Oprah.
Doesn't it? Right. She never wrote back. And I was so upset that I have not brought, I won't watch her. I haven't watched her show since then. Cause I just felt a little annoyed by that. I mean, the offer still stands and she still hasn't retired. So we'll call it 10 years later.
You got to pick up the correspondence again.
I know. But
you don't remember me, but
dear Oprah, maybe it's a little bit more than 10 years later, but, and she's still, I still not retired. So I was clearly a little off base on my guess of how close she was to retirement. But I'd love to get a book tour because I feel like that, it just cracked me up. I was so dutiful. Like, and in, I wasn't even in the US. Here, she was getting these cross-border letters from some random preteen telling her how old she was.
That's awesome. I can't understand why that strategy didn't work. That sounds really solid to me.
It does, right? And then when the first one didn't work, I just figured we would just inundate her with telling her how old she was.
Yeah.
So, I've learned more of the art of subtlety since then, apparently.
So talk about your book a little bit. Tell me about your book.
Mm-hmm. So I did bring a copy to
look at that. No permission
you.
Needed
no
to bring
permission
that copy.
Needed. Yeah. So really fun. We hit number one new release on Amazon and just got nominated for a Global Book Award. So just really very, I think I told you I've been described as like super practical and pragmatic. The book is literally like that. So really guides people on how to identify what value you bring to the table, the values that you operate on, what are your non-negotiables and why. great stories from some really, really cool women. And then the back half of the book is a workbook. So really great exercises that really just sort of say, like, how do you describe yourself? Why do you describe yourself that way? How could you up-level that a little bit so that it's more focused on the so what and not the what and the how? And it's been really fun.
Well, tell me about one of the people you have in the book. You interviewed women to include in the book?
Yeah, I mean, and the stories are kind of all over the place, right? From somebody who threw up into her purse every time she had to speak extemporaneously at a meeting, which I think
that was her opener. Probably... That's how she started. She's like, excuse me. And she threw up in her purse.
Yes.
And
yes.
That aside.
Yeah. She just was so nervous, And, and I knew that we would get her to a place where that didn't happen. And I knew we got there because one day I got a text from her and she had bought this really nice purse. And I said, oh my God, like, are you sure? She said, yep. Cause she was buying these cheap purses from Target that she could just literally toss in the garbage. So that was a really cool. I knew we made it.
You had to write to Target and say, hey, I've got a new marketing line for you. It's like super lined purses.
You could just like take out like, it sounds like a built-in garbage bag,
yeah.
But, yeah. And just some really, really cool women, how we negotiated compensation, for example, just, you know, a lot of women tend to negotiate against themselves. So they take the first offer and, oh, well, I should just go with this. And no, here's how we're going to get your comp package to 2.5 times what it was by just really understanding that, you know, just because this is the first time you've been in that role doesn't mean they're going to expect less. Or one of the women was fired by a really well-known celebrity CEO. And so that's all anybody wanted to know. Hey, tell me about this person. Right. And it was like Groundhog Day for her. And so we took control of the narrative so that she was able to say, hey, I know what you want to know. Here's what happened, but literally in 10 seconds. And now let's move on and talk about what we're here to talk about today. And just techniques for when people said, well, but let's go back. She said, we've already covered it. There's nothing more to talk about. So just kind of giving people their power back about how to talk about themselves. And then the quantitative and qualitative benefits. It's really interesting because there are very quantitative benefits. Doubling your comp or for your team or your company revenue, the size of the team you manage, things like that. But I can't say that people will text me and say, I feel 62% more confident or my self-doubt is 30% less. But you can see it in the sense of people saying, I'm not afraid to go for this stretch role. I'm not afraid to show up and be at this board meeting. Or even if I don't get the role, it doesn't bother me because I know it's not about me. I know I deserve a seat at the table. This just wasn't the right table for me. So you can see it manifesting in these really strong, positive ways. And just... Dan, every day is so cool because I work with such amazing people who kind of have these really great journeys and they share them. And I get text messages all day like, oh, I aced the interview. Oh, I got the job, whatever. And it's a real privilege.
It is fun to be part of that process. That's what I always liked about teaching is when you know, you can see like in communication and rhetoric are such pragmatic academic areas anyway, like they're almost always instantly applicable to something in your life. And so you could just see it. I remember teaching relational communication once and talking about how do you tell somebody that there's something physical and like a lot of relationships, romantic relationships are done through touch, all sorts of different types of touch. You're constantly touching each other in a good relationship. How do you tell somebody if there's one of those touches that you don't like? And there's this older woman who was coming back and taking classes. And I saw her just kind of, I knew that hit something. I'm like, what is it? And she's like, I've been married for 15 years. I don't like the way my husband kisses. I'm like, 15 years where you're getting under rewarded on that particular, you know, important thing in a relationship. Well, we're going to work on how do you teach him that? How do you talk about that? And when you give them, you know, that kind of specific thing to work on and then skills and approaches with different scripts, they can actually make some kind of progress. And so it is really cool when you can give people pragmatic things that make their life better, their business better, their compensation better.
Really? Yeah. Or just like build a team that doesn't have friction and you know, not only does that enable the whole company or the whole team to actually do its work and be really high efficiency or high, like it can actually do, you can actually do what you're supposed to do. But now suddenly when there's no friction, you can go home at the end of the day and just be like, okay, I'm not as exhausted. I'm not as drained. I'm actually enjoying it. So yeah, there's benefits on all sides. I think it's really interesting what you're talking about too, is how you communicate and how you articulate hard things. We hate hard conversations, right? There's a statistic from Harvard Business Review that 90% of managers avoid hard conversations. Well, if managers are doing it, then imagine the greater group of people are also avoiding it, right? And so kind of helping to unstick, whatever the verb tense is, helping to unstick that so that you're not fearing how to just have a direct conversation and say to somebody, hey, I work best this way. Or how do we reframe the things that we dread so that you can just be really direct and not, it's not conflict, it's not confrontation. It's just a very matter of fact conversation. So that you're, for example, you're framing it in the outcomes that it's going to create and not in the dread of what you think is going to happen during the conversation. So a lot of that stuff, because it's, again, it's really pragmatic, but it really helps on a daily basis for people. The stuff where they're like, I've been putting off this conversation for 4 months or whatever. Oh my God, this conversation is going to take you 18 seconds. 4 months, we've been putting it off. Just stuff like that.
And I think that is probably one of your superpowers, the directness to simply take things on. Like when you see a problem or you want something in front of you, do it. You know, as opposed to talking yourself out of it, hyper worrying about it, making it much bigger than it is. I mean, that skill of being direct, I would say that's probably one of the major things I would guess that you're bringing to people, is just almost modeling that for them, because you are so direct and so unfearful, I think, in the way that you talk, the way you take things on.
I think you can be direct and still be loving. Not squishy,
brutal.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think that's one of the things people fear about being direct is like, oh, well, that's going to make me into an asshole. No, you're not being uncaring. You're just putting the topic or the subject on the table and you're saying, let's look at it. Let's solve it so we can just move on. Like, it's not an elephant in the room. It's probably literally the size of a mouse. It's tiny, I bet. But the more you just fret about it, it's going to get bigger and bigger. Yeah.
Well, I'm getting practice at doing that. Raising my daughter. My daughter was way more dramatic than myself or my son. My family did most things with comedy, you know, even relationship things and, you know, difficult things, we'd still couch it, you know, within comedy to make it softer. But she was a drama person. Like there was a certain segment of her that did not want to do comedy when this particular thing was happening. And so she and I butted heads about it a couple of times. And I finally told her, well, we got a problem, but it's a drama versus comedy problem. I don't do well with drama. I don't do well with people, you know, spilling their guts out in a dramatic way and needing, you know, that kind of melodrama around it. And I know this about myself. I just don't like those particular ways of doing things. And she's like, well, that's who I am. That's partly who I am. So are you telling me you don't like me? I'm like, no, it's a communication problem we've got. So here's the deal. I can take about 10 minutes of it, you know, before I start to like just repulse.
Bristle a little bit. Yeah.
You know, so let's take that first 10 minutes when I've got good energy and I care and connect and empathize, and let's use that. And then if you need more than that, you're going to have to call, you know, somebody else, or, you know, I can comfort you non-verbally. I just, you know, teenage girl emotions were just overwhelming. Like, it's not my game.
And it's really interesting, isn't it, too? Because it's really important to know this kind of reminds me a bit of like the love languages trope, right? Of how do you work best, right? Or how do you communicate best? Or how do you receive information or give information best? And it's totally fine if she's one way, you're another. And if you put that in the workplace even, and I think there's times where you can say to somebody, hey, okay, we're not necessarily on the same page in how we communicate or how we receive information or give it. So if 10 minutes is your limit, that's great. maybe we now move to like Slack, or maybe we move to something where we're taking out the places where we create friction, and we sort of de-escalate where we cause each other like that visceral reaction. It's interesting. I had some stakeholders in my last company who loved yelling. That's how they thrived, and that is exactly how I don't thrive. And so I think this is also just teaching people how to talk about it, where I would just say, hey, you get the best value from me when everyone's calm. But I knew that's how they did that. That's not for them. And so it was sort of like we had to meet in the middle so that everybody was thriving. And it's being really comfortable saying that to people. Hey, I do my best work. You get the best value out of me when the situation is this, or when the mood in the room is this, or when we're speaking at this level, and not apologizing for it, but just saying it and couching it in those terms. Not I prefer it, or I'd really like it if, but I work the best when X. And I never apologized for it, but it was just explaining that that's why I created a certain environment. And if it didn't work for them, no problem. We could come back the next day and have our 10 minutes of calm, or maybe we could just do the meeting. We could do more things in writing, whatever it was, so that everybody was working in their best way.
Yeah. And I think that's the best way of looking at it. Like I've done a ton of group work and writers' rooms and things like that. And everybody's very different in how they work. I had a friend who I've never heard him say a funny word. And he's worked in Hollywood for 20 years. He's a great writer. But he only works if you send him back to his room, his office, shut the door, and leave him alone for 2 hours. He's not a group writer. He's not a pair writer. He just sits in the room, doesn't say anything. He's paying attention. But if you judged him on that, there are other people in the room that are just, just throwing out.
Right. And they thrive on the energy, right? Yeah.
And so, you have to, I think you've probably got a lot of background in that with dealing with teams and how do you shape that. Is that something also that you do courses on, or?
I do. And, it's really interesting because we had a really brilliant engineer at my last company who he was kind of like that, where let's say we had a customer outage or something, and everybody would jump on the phone, and because we're trying to solve it fast, but he wouldn't be there for maybe half an hour. And of course that would make people frustrated. Like, what's he doing? He doesn't think this is urgent, whatever. And I didn't realize that this was causing some friction and a bit of even resentment until they mentioned it. And I said, I just can't see how this guy works 24/7. If I called him at 2 a.m, he'd pick up. Something else is happening. So we got everybody in the same room. And I said, so just walk me through what happens when there's an outage and we all have to jump on it. And he said, well, I go into my hole. I remote into the customer environment. I take like half an hour to really think through all the possibilities. I need that time. I can't be on the phone with 5 or 6 other engineers, everybody going, could be this, could be this, could be this. He said, usually by the time I emerge, I have figured it out. Everyone else is still running around like a chicken with no head. And it just took everybody hearing that before they realized he wasn't slacking. He was actually going to do sort of first level root cause analysis, but on his own. That's how he did his best work. But I think once everybody realized that, they were fine. There was no resentment. There was no frustration. He just waited until he said, hey, I've done my first level of stuff and now I'm ready to join. I think it's just understanding how people work. And then you have that empathy and it turns like a versus into an S. Does that make sense? It turns the letter.
Turns the a versus into an S?
Yeah, no, like it turns like before it was like us versus him, right? Like what he's, but it kind of collapses that V into an S. It just makes everybody understand that we're all working differently, but we're going towards the same goal, just right. In a different way. Yeah, collapse that distance.
I think a good manager, that's what they do. They're good at creating hyper transparency. So everybody understands what everybody's doing before they judge it. We're often judging on 10% of the information or making all these assumptions about what's going on. And until you've got information, you can't really make good decisions. So the only way to get that is to have hyper transparency, and a good manager knows, like a good head writer would know everybody's way of working, and they wouldn't impinge on it because they would know I'm not going to get good results from that person if I put them in the wrong environment.
Totally. But we're so inundated with information that I think sometimes it's hard to convince people to stop and take a little time to learn about even yourself. Some people don't even know this stuff about themselves. So that's the first one. And then your team, how does everybody else prefer to be communicated with, communicated to, communicate themselves, things like that. So I do a lot of facilitation and workshops and things where it's like, even creating just a company wiki or on Slack, just putting some basic information that says, I'm really not good at unannounced phone calls. Just something simple, or, you know, I'm a night owl. Just stuff that says, if there's a problem, I really am great if you send me an email so I can absorb it, I can think, and now I'm ready. Some people are like, hey, hit me up, I'm great, I'm really good on the fly. Just putting some basic information about how you work best really helps other people, and in turn it will help you. So yeah, that's a lot of the work that I do.
Well, I think that sense of how do you find tactics to make these things real, you know, in work environments, like that idea of people disclosing some of their preferences about how they like to be talked to, what time of day they like to work, how much coffee they need, you know, all these things, like everybody's their own little tornado of needs that they, you know, they have. And whether that's functional with the rest of the group or not, you know, who knows? And that's where you get that sense of, you know, group, you know, versus like group productivity versus individual productivity is so different.
Yeah, it is.
Weaving all those different tornadoes together so that they're doing something, you know, sort of mass productive, it's an art.
It is. It is. And that's why I really, like you said, I think a really good manager or a really good functioning team, they kind of all know about each other, right? They know how each other works. They know, my team was great. They know I'm not a morning person. So they knew that only in the rarest of occasions would a 7 or 8 o'clock meeting be okay, only if it was really, truly necessary. I think it's just, we all had a really good working understanding of how everybody thrived.
And I think setting the tone, right? Setting that as an agreement that everybody's going to make of, hey, we've got to learn each other. We have to do some adaptation to each other so that we can become a, you know, a very functional, coherent team. When people come in with those agreements, you know, you can basically work through anything at that point. If they come in with not those agreements of, I'm going to be moody over here and I'm not going to disclose and I'm just going to resent, that's a different type of problem that you have to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's usually when I get brought in, when there's friction, or let's say there's people that have a lot of institutional legacy knowledge, and then there's new people. And the pandemic didn't help because everyone was remote for so long. And now people are coming back to this hybrid. So people don't necessarily know how other people work and why. I think the why is really important. I always get a kick out of this. People will just say, hey, my superpower is whatever, empathy, or I lead with, I don't know, transparency. That's great, but I want to know why. And you should be able to say why and why it matters. Because I can tell you, I've never had somebody say to me, hey, we have a board seat open or we're looking for a CEO. Who's the most empathetic executive that you know? That half my book is about values and how you lead. But we first have to know what's the hard side of you, right? Are you a go-to-market person? Are you a finance? Like, how do you create value? And then what are the sort of softer skills that actually coalesce around it to activate it, if that makes sense? Mm-hmm. And so when someone just comes and says to me, hey, so good to meet you, my superpower is this, I think probably not going to get you very far, because no boardroom has ever said, you know, we really need around here, we need five people with superpowers that are soft skills. We've got to lead with the hard skills, make sure that that's all checking all the boxes, and then overlay it with the culture piece and the values piece.
It's an interesting perspective. That's very technology driven, right? Like, you've got to be able to do your job. You've got to have the skills. You've got to be able to write this code, the language, you know, this code. Yeah. You know, I don't know what to tell you. I don't care if you're, you know, I can empathize with you not being able to write this code, but, you know, that's not going to help us much.
Yeah. But I also think it comes back to how you talk about yourself, because if you walk around just saying to people, oh, I'm a super empathetic leader, that's fabulous, but I don't really know what to do with you. If you can say to me, hey, I am known for, you know, driving a lot of revenue by helping SaaS companies expand internationally, something like that. I pulled it out of my ass, but let's say now I can sort of figure out what kind of company, what mm-hmm. kind of position, what kind of whatever. And then if you say to me, one of the ways I really activate that is that I'm known for being a very empathetic and collaborative leader, and that whatever that activates my value as a leader this way. Okay, now that's contextualized, right? But I really don't love the word superpower because it tends to be totally out of context,
right?
In a lot of cases.
Unless it's I can see through walls, you know, or
I have
heat vision.
I was bitten by a spider. Yeah.
Well, yeah. We're coming up on an hour. Why don't you pitch yourself a little bit? Like, if people are interested, where do they find you? What are they going to find? What type of people, you know, are you looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I really, I help people do this, and it's so hard to do it for yourself.
Sure.
So I do a lot of keynote speaking, workshops, sales kickoffs, facilitation of, you know, executive and corporate offsites. I think I really help individuals and teams figure out how to work the best together. And like I said, how to create that sense of their mission, themselves, their value, and then how to create value for the company through there. So, I really do a lot of really fun and, like I said, really pragmatic keynotes. So if you just want to be inspired, I'm not your girl. If you want to be, if you want to have three things that you can immediately start doing that will move the needle, that's the kind of keynote or workshop that you're going to get. I do work one-on-one with a handful of people each quarter. It's very high touch, very white glove, senior executives. And I have a couple courses on my website, which is tissarichards.com, which is really
Tissa
great.
Richards.
Tissarichards.com. And those are very much around helping people who are looking to get onto corporate boards. Or, so that's the first one. It's called My Board Blueprint. And the next one is about figuring out how do you lead? Why do you lead that way? And that's called Unlocking My Leadership. But it has been just really fun. I love everything I do. And then the book, No Permission Needed. So it's on Audible and Amazon.
So you have organized a lot of your content into products
yes.
that people can access if they want, yes. You know, to get some access to the things that you've learned in this, you know, really, I mean, I know like some of the stuff you've done. I knew, you when you were running your last company, I was there when like the pressure of it was crushing you. And,
totally.
And I've seen, you know, it's like Kirsten, who we met through, same thing, just like crushed by entrepreneurism, you know, for so long. And so I've known you through that, and it's really nice to see you much more relaxed and not, you know.
Totally. It's just, and I do, and this is why I do still coach and sort of help and mentor founders, and I'm rolling onto the board of two companies that are raising money. But it's fun to do it like one degree removed, where, you know, the pressure is not on you directly, and you can sort of help people do it in a way that isn't going to suck their soul. And then working with much bigger companies and, you know, Fortune 500s and really hyperscale organizations, because it's that startup life is a grind. It's not sexy. It's not glamorous. We really over-glamorize it.
It's just too much. There's too many jobs. People are like, oh, I'm juggling a lot. I'm like, you're juggling 500 things. That is not sustainable. And, you know, 400 of them you're not good at. So
No.
Is that a
but
good
you don't
plan?
Have a choice. No, you don't have a choice because you don't have the capital to bring anyone on.
Well, I talk about this with my partner. You've met Matt, you know, at 500 mm-hmm. Rockets. And it's like, we cannot find companies that are properly funded. You know, yeah. You come in and you're like, hey, you guys need this. We can do this. And here's the budget. And they're like, oh, that's like 10 times. I'm like, why are you even talking to people then? Because you have to have capital to bring in good resources. So, and then you go out and chase capital all the time, which it is a grind.
It's a grind. And that's why I every day, Dan, I open up my calendar and I think, oh my gosh, like what is on here today, and it's fun, it's meaningful. The people I work with are amazing. I have a no assholes rule, which is hard when you're raising money or you're in a startup, because you're much more, you can't be quite as selective, although you should be. And yeah, so it's truly such a blessing. And it's kind of like taking all the lessons of being a founder and a CEO and saying, I'm only going to do the amazing things that I love with amazing people that are truly kick-ass and love every minute of it. I mean, I truly knock on wood every day.
Well, I've always enjoyed talking to you. I think you offer good things to the world. You're super smart and experienced. So I would recommend people to go, you know, check out your stuff and talk to you, because there's a lot of value in Tissa Richards.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come and, well, catch up for one thing, but to talk about the book and the keynotes and stuff. And I'd love people to just come and reach out, and I'd be really excited to do a workshop or come and speak to your company.
Yeah. Tissa's very, very accessible, very friendly to talk to, reach out, connect. And I recommend it. So thanks again for doing this.
Yeah.
Go to TissaRichards.com. And anything else before you go?
No, just thank you. It's so good to see your face. It's been way too long.
Yeah, I have people scattered across the country. You know, America is just a big scatter of humans that I like, you know, and it's just so hard to get in the same places over time with them, at least on Zoom, you know, like doing this podcast. I've reconnected to people that I haven't talked to for 30 years. Like, I went to grad school with a guy who teaches in China. And I just hit him up on, I was like, hey, why don't you jump on this podcast? And super fun.
Oh, fun. Oh, what a fun thing. And I mean, you're so good at it. I just feel like it's just like chatting to a friend. It's so cool.
Yeah. I enjoy it. So, well, awesome. Well, like I said, check out TissaRichards.com. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade some people. The whole world needs persuasion.